A Spy Named Orphan, written by Roland Phillips and read by Jonathan Keeble. Donald MacLean awoke on the 25th of May 1951 at his house in the quiet Kent village of Tatsfield to a beautiful late spring day, a welcome change in the weather. That Friday morning would be his last in England. It was his 38th birthday. He ate his breakfast of bacon and eggs with two cups of tea in his usual haste. The housekeeper and nanny to his sons, Fergus and young Donald, known as Beanie, entered the comfortable Victorian villa to see him rush upstairs to kiss his American wife, Melinda, goodbye. Remarkably, given the traumatic year they had just had, Melinda was now 8 months pregnant with their third child. Donald came back downstairs, quickly watered the cyclamen that Melinda had bought him, bent his long frame into his car, and set off for Oxted Station and the commuter train to London's Victoria. When he arrived in London, the tall, slender, elegantly pinstriped diplomat with his trademark bow tie, his good looks, now with an air of distinction about them as his blonde hair was starting to grey, walked briskly from the station through St. James's Park, which was in full flower, to the Foreign Office. The man with the trilby and unnecessary raincoat had to adopt an undignified scurry to keep pace with MacLean's stride. It was almost as if the taller man were taunting him. MacLean was at his desk as head of the American department by 10 a.m. as usual. He was young for such a prestigious job, the latest promotion in what had so far been, with one setback, a remarkably successful career. He was on track to reach the heights of his profession, the major ambassadorship certainly, perhaps even ending up as permanent secretary. His friends were already calling him Sir Donald MacLean, OHMS, in recognition of his work on His Majesty's service. Here was a cultivated, laconic mandarin who was also a highly experienced Soviet agent, and MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence service, were onto him. MacLean's employers had been exceptionally loyal. They had not only brought him back into the fold the previous winter, but they had promoted him to his influential new post. Less than a year before, he had been in the throes of paranoid alcoholism and had come close to bringing disgrace upon British diplomacy. When one of his oldest friends had picked him up at the station on his way to stay with her in Wiltshire, she had been so alarmed by his appearance that she took him first to a friend's garden to relax before driving him home. As he lay on piled-up cushions beneath a beech tree, he was seized by an attack of delirium tremens so violent that he kept jumping up to fight the branches above him. An acquaintance saw him soon afterwards and described him as looking as if he had spent the night sitting up in a tunnel. A year on, and a delicious lunch in Soho seemed a fitting celebration, both of his birthday and of his recovery.